Please come to order. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judges Hooton, Jessen, and Klopphagi. Judge Carol Hooton presiding.
Good morning, counsel. This is the case of CHS Capital LLC versus Lena Farms Partnership. Counsel, I want to first of all thank you for agreeing to participate in this grand experiment of doing our oral arguments over the internet, and hopefully we'll make this work. Counsel, I know that you are both cross appellates. Will you each want 5 minutes of rebuttal?
Please.
Yeah, I would. Thank you.
All right. Very good then. Since it is a cross appeal, you will each have 5 minutes for rebuttal, 15 minutes for your oral arguments. And for the appellants may begin. That would be CHS. And if you'll please introduce yourself and let us know who you're representing. We'd appreciate it. Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is John Brockie, and I represent the appellant, CHS Capital LLC, in this proceeding. The facts with respect to the appeal of CHS Capital are straightforward. From 2012 to 2014, the respondents Brian and Shogun and their various businesses obtained operating loans from CHS Capital. Collateralized the resulting debts. The Haugens and their businesses granted CHS Capital security interests, essentially all of their personal property, including but not limited to crops and farm equipment. CHS Capital perfected its liens by the filing of financing statements with the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State. Well, the Haugens were...
Can I ask you this question? Because, I mean, aren't we concerned here with how the parties defined the collateral here? And I'm looking specifically at the three security agreements. Is that the language we should be looking at to decide what is covered here as collateral?
We should.
And with reference to that, I have several questions. One is with regard to the crops, in interpreting this as crops that were grown by, is it Haugen or
Haugen, I believe, Your Honor.
Haugen, okay. Grown by the Haugens. Is that, am I correct at that? And that either now into the future?
And it's actually crops grown not only by Brian and Shannon Haugen, but their various business entities that are also listed as debtors on the security agreement. And for purposes of our, that's Lena Farms Partnership.
All right. Well, let me ask you this question then. Does this agreement then only pertain to crops in which the grantors have an interest?
Yes.
All right. And I guess that's the key question here. What crops do they have an interest? Am I correct?
Right. Exactly. And as we present in our brief, there are two ways of looking at an interest. And the first way is the way the court decided the matter. And what the court found is that in 2015, and that's the critical year, Lena Farms Partnership leased 3,100 acres of farmland from another of Brian Haugen's entities by the name of Lena Land Lease Company. Lena Farms Partnership enrolled all of those acres with the Federal Government Farm Service Agency, verifying that Lena Farms Partnership was the sole operator on that 3,100 acres in 2015. Lena Farms Partnership also obtained crop insurance, the entirety of the 3,100 acres, verifying that it had a 100% interest in all crop grown on that 3,100 acres. We know from the record that Lena Farms Partnership completed planting of the entirety of the 3,100 acres in late May of 2015. Thereafter, until or fourth, that management attempted to acquire any interest in 100 acres of the subject crops. And the record has been, yes, Your Honor.
All right, could I ask you this question then? Yeah, I mean, isn't one of the issues here when this security interest attaches?
I mean, yes.
And so that planting of the crops, would that trigger the attachment of the security interest?
Right. To my understanding, we need to show three facts to establish attachment of CHS Capital security interest. First, the value given. And it's undisputed that the loan CHS Capital made from 2012 to 2014 gave value. Next, we need to establish Lena Farms Partnership signed an agreement pledging crops. Disputed the Lena Farms Partnership signed a security agreement in favor of CHS Capital pledging all crops whenever grown, whether or not harvested, every crop. And finally, then the question is Lena Farms Partnership acquiring an interest in the crops. And the case law is clear that once crops are planted, at a minimum, the debtor acquires an interest in those crops and the security interest attaches.
Is there some question as to who actually planted all of these crops?
No. The sign up with Farm Service Agency establishes that Lena Farms Partnership was the sole operator. The crop insurance filing establishes that Lena Farms Partnership had a 100% interest in those crops. And it wasn't until July that there was an attempt to transfer these filings with FSA and the crop insurance company, 95% to central management. But as the testimony showed and the trial court found, you can't transfer either FSA filings or most particularly crop insurance filings unless you did at the start of the farming year and at the time of planting have sole rights in those crops. If in fact central management had acquired its interest in 3,100 acres or any crops before planting, the crop insurance couldn't have been transferred. The only course of action was that central management would have had to obtain its own crop insurance policy, and there would have been no transfer. Again, the record is undisputed that the crops were planted by Lena Farms Partnership when it had sole control of that acreage. And again, remember, it had sole rights under the lease with Lena Land Lease Company.
So, Mr. Brocky, if I may,
yes.
That's part of my big question in this case. Why do we have to look beyond that lease? So we've got the sublease from LLL to Lena, giving them 100% interest in the land. Why isn't that enough, that interest?
It is.
Which happened here before. But if that's true, then why isn't the sublease Ponslet have kind of giving her the 95% interest? Why isn't that definitive? So help us answer those questions.
Yes, perfect. The question is, though, when the Ponslet sublease was signed. And just like with Lena Farms Partnership and Central, we have Gen X signing up with FSA saying, I'm the sole operator of the land. We have Gen X taking a crop insurance policy out on the entirety of the acres saying, I am the sole operator. And it's not until July that there is a transfer of rights with FSA or the crop insurance company. And so we have the same problem that we do with central management. Ponslet didn't acquire her interest in the Gen X land until after the crop had been planted.
I thought that there was a April 15th agreement or something that was effective then. Is that not the case? You know this record better.
All these leases are dated April 15th, but the uncontested evidence is that the form of the lease that gave a 95% interest wasn't created until the end of May, beginning of June. And we know, and the trial court found specifically, that that lease wasn't signed by central management until June 3rd or 4th. So Ponslet also couldn't have signed that identical form of lease, giving her a 95% interest until after it was created. And in June. So the crops had been planted by that time. We don't need to look at the date of the lease because we know they backdated the lease. But the problem was that by that time the crop had been planted, they were simply trying to do an end run around the facts of the case. The crop was planted, the security interest had attached, and that was really the end of the argument, and there was no way for them to save themselves by this sleight of hand with the leases. And it's important to note, take a look at written discovery responses, particularly on central management. Central management admits that this lease signed in June 3rd and 4th is the only lease. Now, at trial, they tried to claim there was a prior oral lease, a prior written lease, but it simply flew in the face of their sworn discovery responses. DIP's situation is no different with Ponsla. Again, this was an attempt to backdate a lease to cover up what the crop insurance filing and the FSA filing, as the court found, already established, that by the time the crop was planted, only Lena Farms Partnership and only Gen X had interest in the land.
Can so, I ask you this, though? Under this definition of what constitutes collateral, if in fact there had just been simply a sublease with all with the Hoggins and their companies only receiving rents, the bank wouldn't have any rights to attach the rents. Am I correct?
I apologize, Your Honor. I missed the last part of your question.
All right. Let's just assume, I mean, I'm just looking at this definition of what constitutes collateral. If in fact, the Hoggins had just simply did a sublease to Gen X or in even Ponsulate, or Gen X had done a sublease to the Ponsulate, if that had been the only thing that was done, the bank would not have any rights to the crops that were grown. Am I correct? In other words, it was 100% sublease done before any planting was done. Am I correct? The bank would not have any rights under that circumstance?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And that's the second argument we made. Now, this second argument wasn't the basis with the trial court. I want to make that clear. The trial court specifically found the crops were planted and central management retained their interest. But the law is that as long as you have rights to plant a crop, it's the inchoate right that this court referenced in 1986. As long as you have rights to plant crop, your transfer of the property later on, even before the crop doesn't cut off the security interest that already attached by the virtue of the fact that you had the rights to farm that land in the particular year.
But if we adopt that, then why, I mean, wouldn't that basically prohibit any lessor or lessee from ever subleasing?
No.
If we interpret it that way?
No, not because of the particular facts in this case, because we know that the central management and Ponsla were well aware of the security interest of CHS Capital. We know that they did this solely to try to cut off that security interest. And where you've got that knowledge, the subtenant is not a good faith purchaser for value, so to speak. They have knowledge, which precludes them from taking that land and trying to, again, do an end run around the security interest that's already been created by their landlord. So to conclude this argument.
Well, can I clarify your answer? Are you just saying in this case that would not happen because of the knowledge they had of this prior
Correct.
Security interest?
Correct.
But generally, in looking at the language of this, assuming there had not been that knowledge, would the bank have any rights under this agreement just by virtue of the?
I think absent that knowledge, absent the fact they couldn't be good faith, they couldn't acquire rights in good faith, the bank would not have a security interest.
Okay, thank you.
Now, the trial court in its initial ruling went from its findings that all the crop had been planted before central management and Ponsulate acquired any interest in the property, and held that CHS capital security interest attached to 100% of that crop. On a motion for remittitor, the trial court decided that as to the 3,100 acres farmed by Lena Farms Partnership, CHS Capital's security interest would only to the acres farmed in 2015 that Lena Farms Partnership had farmed previously in 2014. The court never explained its rationale for that argument, and applying the facts to the law, the court made a mistake. Because
was that a motion for remittitor, or was that a motion for clarification?
I understood it was a motion for remittitor, which didn't, of course, really fit to the circumstances, but the court did give relief, however you characterize it. The point is, though, the court did not change its findings. The court still had concluded that all the crop had been planted before central management acquired any rights in the property. So whether Lena Farms Partnership had farmed any of the acreage in 2014 or earlier years was legally irrelevant to the fact that CHS's security interest already attached to all the crop farmed on the 3,100 acres in 2015. Thank you, Your Honors. I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, which I think is 5 minutes.
That is correct. Thank you. And the respondent may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Rocky. My name is Robert Benner. I'm with the Dunlap and Seeger Law down in Rochester, and I am one of the attorneys who represents the respondents and cross appellants in this case. I guess avoid getting into the high level facts of the case about how the loans with Brian and Shannon Haugen came into creation. I want to talk about a few things that we can't agree on with CHS. The main issue in this case, and the court is all over it, is who had the ownership in the crops that were planted in 2015. Was it central management? Was it Monica Ponsulate, or was it Brian Haugen and his entity, or Shannon Haugen and his entity? I do think that what is lost in the record is, and the district court missed this, despite having dealt with this case for upwards of 3 years before issuing the rule. Shannon Haugen and Monica Ponsulate's farming operation is completely separate and distinct from that of what took place with central management and Brian Haugen. The court seems to think that all four were all tied together. Binds them together is the fact that Brian Haugen and Shannon Haugen were parties to the security agreements and the loans with CHS. From 2015 going forward, Brian Haugen farmed independently, I guess even in 2014, as did Shannon Haugen. When the subleasing of the acreage took place, there was an agreement between Shannon Haugen and Monica Ponsulate that she would take over acres previously farmed by Shannon Haugen and the Gen X entity. On the other side of the equation, it was central management who made the agreements with Brian Haugen to take over the farming operation and the acres that were available in 2015. The two did not interact or have any other involvement with each other. And I think that when you read the decisions and findings, that's lost in there. He seems to lump them all together, which is not what reality is. But the second thing that we can agree on with CHS is that the district court's findings of fact are an absolute mess. The cornerstone of the district court's finding was a credibility determination that rests upon the laurels of a statement in the district court's ruling that it defies all credulity that central management would by happenstance be farming the identical acres that Brian Haugen had previously farmed. It was on that basis, and this gets to the court's questions about was it a motion for remittitor or was it a motion for clarification of the facts. It was uncontested during the trial that central management farmed at least 43% of the acres it farmed had never been farmed by Brian Haugen in previous years. but the court completely ignored that, made the conclusion or finding of fact that all of the acres were the same and that it was purpose for the defendants to now come in and claim that, you know, this wasn't some type of sham transaction. All of his credibility findings trickled through the remainder of his findings of fact in this order based upon the conclusion that he thought that there was something afoot here, and he was just dead wrong on that. And so that's where, you know, CHS wants to say, you know, look at this, look at this, look at this. Well, you can't look at any of the remaining findings that the district court made because they're all flawed.
Counsel, are you arguing that we should find as clearly erroneous the district court?
I think it's easily done, Judge Newton, because Judge Clark admitted he made the error and that he was, I think the director was confused about the facts and that he admits he was wrong. But what he didn't do was go back into his findings and make those corrections and tie those into the conclusions of law that he did clarify.
Was the trial judge's admission of confusion related to the SAM discussion the trial judge had, or was that confusion related to something else?
No, it's directly related to his conclusion that the defendants were not telling the truth. I think if you look at that key finding where he states it defies credulity that central management by happening, you know, and I'm not able to directly quote it, I can find it. I've got it in my notes here, but I don't want to lose time with me shuffling through electronic paper here, is that it defies credulity for the court to be asked to believe that central management by happenstance just happened to farm the identical acres that Brian Haugen had farmed in prior years.
But you went back to the trial court, and the trial court wasn't willing, apparently, to amend those findings.
Judge, he did well, and that's where the error is. He corrected the conclusions of law. He admitted he made the mistake, but what he didn't do was go back into the findings of fact, which he should have done, and correct the findings to fit the mistake of the facts that he found. And so, you know, what we're asking for here on CHS's issue is either to reverse the district court on those or remand it to the district court for clarification of the findings of fact in light of the admitted mistake.
I mean, you recognize that this would be a unique case where we would conclude that the trial court was clearly erroneous on a finding of fact when it was based.
I sure do, and I appreciate that the Court of Appeals is defer to credibility determinations of the district court, but on this instance where the judge's credibility determination is almost wholly founded on an admitted mistake in the facts, I think it's an appropriate case for it to be remanded to the district court for him to issue the clarification so that we all have some direction on it.
All right, Mr. Benner, could we talk about the definition of collateral in the security agreements? You know, counsel for CHS has indicated that he believes that as soon as there was a crop planted here, that would trigger the rights under the security agreement. In other words, if the Haugens had planted something on either of these properties, and if that can be shown, that would trigger CHS's rights. Do you agree with that?
I'm going to edge and tell you I do in part. Where is with Mr. Brockie's representation to the court that it's acknowledged and agreed by everyone. This gets back credibility issue, and I don't want to beat that again, but you know, under the hypothetical that Brian Haugen did pay for, actively participate in the planting, and prepare to go forward with the crop commencing in late April of 2015, then yes, he would be a have an ownership interest in the crops, but the facts are that's not what happened. For the Brian Haugen Central Management activities, Central Management engaged a custom farmer in January 2015, arranged financing and began buying the inputs, and then organized the planting of the crop commencing in April. So there is a huge disagreement over what happened here.
All right. Are there sufficient findings in this record for us to make, for us to know if the court made that determination or not as to whether these crops were planted before the either lease was signed, either sublease was signed?
It ties back to the error made by the court and the court's admitted confusion. He didn't even reference any of the farming activity that took place by Central Management that's within the record. He completely ignored the involvement of John Trias as the custom farmer and obliterated that by relying upon his conclusion that Central Management and Brian Haugen were lying, because it just defied all credulity that it would be conceivable management showed up and farmed the identical 3,100 acres that and you know, it's with that finding that taints the entire factual record in this case. So our position is that, you know, this court needs to hold Judge Clark accountable for his admitted mistake, get this thing back in his hands for clarification, so we all actually know what we're dealing with here.
So Mr. Benner, if I may, could we turn to the Gen X issue?
Sure.
Away from the Central Management issue. You know, speaking for myself, not for the panel, kind of my inclination would be if there was a signed sublease on April 15th, then I'd say, well, okay, Gen X didn't have an interest in 95% of those crops because of that signed sublease, but it wasn't signed on April 15th. It was effective April 15th. How should we handle that or address that? Do we need to remand it? Or is the fact it wasn't one something that we can just then disregard and should disregard the sublease altogether?
I don't think we go to the point of disregarding the sublease. The, you know, Mr. Brockie has represented to the court that there was a finding that Monica Ponsulate and Shannon Howe executed the lease, the Gen X lease, after June of 2015. Good luck finding that in the record. There is no finding on that. There was no testimony about the timing. In fact, the only testimony related to the timing and execution of the lease between Gen X and Monica Ponsulate is that that agreement signed and executed in April, and that is consistent with Monica Ponsulate going to her bank and securing an operating loan for the additional acres. Judge Clark did not make any specific findings about that. I again, it goes back to him just completely rejecting everything the defendants said across the board because of his conclusion that since CM, I mean, the identical acres that Brian Haugen had farmed, that they're all lying. That is a huge, you know, and then he admits that he was dead wrong, but he doesn't fix it. So it's not clear. Our position is the only evidence in the record is that Monica Ponsulate and Ben Haugen signed the Gen X sublease in April, and the record supports that conclusion. And under Mr. Brockie's analysis, he's telling you with that even then Monica is not a good faith purchaser, but that's not the situation. Minnesota does not afford a right to creditor to prohibit a person with an ownership interest or a leasehold interest in real property from conveying that to someone else. The security agreements don't go that far. That's what mortgages are for. I do want to get to some of the other issues on our appeal just briefly. You know, we feel in this case that the defendants, in particular Monica Ponsulate and Central Management, had a jury trial for that. Who was the owner of the property? This collateral. The United Prairie case sets out the analysis. You need to look at the substance of going on. And what happened here is that two third parties to a security agreement lost their right to have the case decided by their neighbors or the citizens of Goodhue County. And, you know, just shouldn't happen that way. If they want to exercise their right to have a jury trial, they should have been afforded that opportunity.
I'm familiar with, over the years, being an equitable action or a statutory action where there were fact questions within that action that were then, I don't know now, was that by whether or not that was based on the Constitution, but are you familiar with that approach? And would that approach be applicable here?
I am familiar with it. I have been involved in cases where there were both blended issues of equity and law, and in some of those instances, with the court reserving the right to decide some of the issues, with an advisory jury providing guidance on those, and then the jury deciding the legal issues, and the court being bound by the determination on the verdict form on those counts. I think it would have been appropriate here, but I still am of the opinion from Central Management and Monica Ponsulet that they had a right to a jury trial that was taken away from them by Judge Clark. And we would ask for a reversal and a new trial on that basis. The last issue that I want to toss in front of the court and Mr. Brocky in my 14 seconds is it defies absolutely all logic or reason how Mr. Brocky and CHS, in defiance of the federal court bankruptcy court order discharging Brian and Shannon Haugen from obligations on this debt, have been able to continue to pursue a judgment. They are in direct violation of the automatic stay and the injunction, as is Judge Clark, and we would ask for those judgments against them personally to be vacated.
Were there any documents submitted to Judge Clark with regard to the bankruptcy and what the holding was?
There were, Judge Hooten, you know, and I guess, you know, call it.
Because he claims he didn't have anything in his he couldn't really rule on it.
He had the discharge documents and the orders from the bankruptcy court submitted to him. And frankly, we shouldn't even be talking about this issue. Mr. Brocky and CHS should have never submitted a request for a judgment against Brian and Shannon Haugen. It just shouldn't have ever happened. And Judge Clark should know better, and so should Mr. Brocky.
All right, thank you. Any rebuttal, please?
Thank you, Your Honors. It isn't lost in the record that the farming operation pursued by Shannon Haugen and Gen X is distinct from the farming operation pursued by Brian Haugen and Lena Farr's partnership. The problem is, though, that the same facts challenge the facts or the posture taken by both of those respondents. It's clear from the record that at the beginning of 2015, both Jax and Lena Farr's partnership intended to farm all of that acreage on their own. And it wasn't until the beginning of summer that it was clear they weren't going to get financing. That's when they tried to bring in Ponsulet and Central Management, but by that time it was too late. Now, the argument by respondents is that one mistake, allegedly, by the court as to comparing the acres that Lena Farr's partnership farmed in 14 versus 15 somehow. Can Your Honor still hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Somehow taints the whole record, but that's nonsense. First, the court didn't find the acres were identical. You can't find that in the record. Second, credibility is not relevant to the fact that there was clearly a lease for all of the 3,100 acres from Lena Land Lease to Lena Farr's partnership. That doesn't require a credibility determination. The emails are clear between Haugen and Central Management that all the terms of the alleged 95% sublease had not been negotiated until early June. That doesn't require a credibility determination.
Can I just clarify what your argument is? Because if we had a lease that was 95-5 split between the lessee and the lessor,
right,
without any evidence that there had been a prior planting, wouldn't the total interest of the Hoggins, and in this case, be limited to the 5% of that sublease? And that's assuming that we don't have the prior planting issue.
Yeah.
Am I correct about that?
The court did say there was planting by the time all the crops had been planted.
Right,
but here's your question. And this is the same question we talked about earlier, Your Honor. Because of the facts in this case, the knowledge that no, the 95% would not save central management, even if it had been signed before the crops were planted. But if central management had truly been ignorant of everything, then perhaps if the sublease had been signed before anything was planted, central management might have taken that 95% of the crop free and clear of the security interest of CHS Capital. But that's not what the facts were.
All right.
And that's not how the court determined the case.
So if we look at whether there was prior planting, I mean, we have to resolve that issue in order to deal with this case as to whether there was prior planting or
no,
not.
I don't think so. Again, because of the fact that we know that Lena Farr's partnership and Gen X had the right to farm this land. And then they tried to do an end run around CHS Capital's security interest by this 95% lease. And they're not good faith purchasers for value of a rights in that land. If you want to look at credibility problems, though, it's not just testimony about the acreage. It's a sworn affidavit that's contradicted at trial. It's sworn discovery responses contradicted at trial. It's repeated conflicts in the testimony. If, in fact, the judge's ruling was dependent on credibility determination, there is a vast amount of evidence in the record supporting his conclusion that defendants were simply not telling the truth. But again, we're relying upon the first sublease, the crop insurance records, the FSA records, the emails. Again, there's simply no credibility that's required to determine that for central management, that sublease wasn't signed until June 3rd or 4th. And the crop insurance records clearly establish that all the crop was planted before that time. So let's talk about Ponslet. Now, it's important to look at, for example, page 20 of the appendix, where the court specifically said that Shannon Haugen signed several documents indicating that Gen X had a 100% interest in growing crops. So again, this is a situation where the evidence established that in writing, Gen X and Shannon Haugen were saying, we own all these crops. The Ponslet sublease was backdated, and we know backdating is ineffective to cut off CHS's security interest. Now, unfortunately, I can't see Michael's clock because that screen is timed out on me. Can somebody tell me how many minutes I have left, if any?
You are over time right now. So,
can I take 30 seconds?
I think you can have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize. On the jury issue first, you look at the plaintiff's complaint, it's clear it's simply a foreclosure action. There is no right to a jury trial in a foreclosure proceeding. Even if that wasn't the case, you can waive by not timely asking for a jury, and they waited over 2 years to ask for a jury on the eve of trial, stipulating the multiple scheduling orders for a court trial. As far as bankruptcy, the problem is there's simply no evidence in the record of Shannon and Brian Haugen's bankruptcy. Even if there was, there's no evidence showing that the debts were dischargeable. So the court's judgment is correct. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And I think Mr. Benner, you also have 5 minutes for a rebuttal since it is a cross appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just go backwards here. The bankruptcy issue shouldn't be involved in this district court issue. Mr. Baraki is a well-seasoned creditor's right lawyer. He is litigates cases across the country, and he knows better. And it wasn't up to the Haugens to come into a state district court and prove that the debts had been discharged in bankruptcy. You couple with that the fact that they're in the adversary proceeding in the bankruptcy court, that there was a settlement agreement which the Haugens performed on. And yet here he is still arguing that CHS is entitled to a judgment in state district court against the Haugens. It's ridiculous. And, you know, we will be pursuing relief through this court, which I think you should give us. And if not, I guess we'll take it up on a contempt motion in the bankruptcy court. There is just absolutely, he has not cited one single legal principle that entitles CHS to maintain a personal judgment against Brian and Shannon Haugen following a discharge in bankruptcy. And trying to flip the burden onto the defendants to prove that they shouldn't be subject to it is nuts. Getting to the issue of the argument that Brian Haugen placed and reported to the FSA that he had crop insurance and that he was responsible for these acres occurred well before planting began. And what the court also needs to be aware of is that central management also had insurance in its own name covering the crops planted in Minnesota, and that that coverage was in place well in advance of April of 2015. So
can
this
I ask you the judge's clarification? What was the rationale for splitting the acres up the way the court did?
So if you
and how did the court reach that number?
If you look at the district court's original opinion, and this is where the facts go wrong, he issued his entire opinion predicated upon his finding of fact that central management farmed the identical 3,100 acres which Brian Haugen had previously farmed. We brought the motion for the amended findings because that's just dead wrong. It was uncontested at trial that only 53% of the acres were previously farmed by Brian Haugen. We had submitted an exhibit to the court that detailed every single acre farmed and whether it had been previously farmed. And that's where Judge Clark just completely ignored that and completely ignored the fact surrounding central management's hiring of a custom farmer and buying inputs. And, you know, given that Judge Clark did not go back in and correct all of the findings related to the legal conclusion, we're all here left to ponder how he got there. But, you know, that if logic and reason enters the room, that's how he got there. Is we reminded him of that evidence. We reminded him that his finding of fact was dead wrong on that. He admitted he was dead wrong and confused on the facts. But the important thing that I want to keep reminding the court is that finding, and here's what it says, you know, Judge Clark's finding that it is too hard to believe that central management coincidentally farmed the exact same 3,100 acres that LFP had farmed strains credulity was the cornerstone of his factual conclusion that the defendants, all of them, were lying to the court and rejecting everything they had to say. And he has now admitted that he was dead wrong on that, but he didn't go back and fix everything else that was a consequence of that. And that's what we're asking this court to correct by sending it back to clarification. Your question is an excellent question. I don't know how he got where he got because he hasn't told us with adequate findings of fact. Last remaining issue is if you adopt CHS's position, I think despite what he's trying to slip around, what Mr. Brockie's position is that any leasehold or ownership interest in real property where the owner or lessee has a security agreement, anybody who comes in and subleases or plants or grows a permitted crop on that land is going to be subject to the creditor security agreement. That's not the law in Minnesota, never has been. We rely upon the Souchard case that cited in our case in Minstat 557.10 that the person who has a right to plant the crops and who produces the crop should be deemed the owner. The district court did not follow those cases, instead went outside of Minnesota and relied upon cases in North North Dakota, Georgia, and elsewhere. We should keep this simple and follow our own law. Absent any other questions, I see that I'm out of time.
Any other questions? Very good. Thank you. Thank you again for agreeing to have this oral argument. We were actually happy that you wanted to proceed with the oral argument, and it's been helpful. Thank you. And we will take the matter under advisement.
Good day, Your Honors.
Good day.